This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hide and seek.
Joy 94.9.
You are on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. This is your show for exploring sex, sexuality and self. Andrew the Apprentice and James Finlay are here.
That's right. And we've got a nice text here from Steve that says, "I'm glad that you guys made it from the forum in time." And we are not the only ones who made it from the forum in time.
That's right. Dr. Vincent is joining us.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you for joining us. And also, Executive Officer of the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre, Simon Ruth, is with us as well. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening, guys.
Now, were you pleased with the turnout tonight for the prep forum, Simon?
Simon.
I thought it was a fantastic turnout for the prep forum tonight, and I was particularly interested in the number of young guys who were there.
Mm.
It was a lot of very different faces, so clearly this issue is gaining a lot of attention.
And Vincent, was the audience informed about PrEP before they arrived? Was it a knowledgeable audience, do you think?
Yeah, I got the feel from the audience that it was a knowledgeable audience. I mean, I think it's fair to say it was probably quite a range of people there with a different range of knowledge about PrEP. But we got some very, very intelligent and some very well-informed questions at the end.
I think there may have been a few researchers in there as well.
I think there may have been a few researchers throwing some curly questions our way.
Using their terminology as well.
That's right.
There are a few questions around the impact that it may or may not have here in Australia. And I think one thing that you might have working against you is that people are so informed about PrEP and PEP and perhaps what they have heard from other countries. Simon, perhaps this is one for you. How are you going to make sure that you're in control as you can be about the message of what PrEP is here to do?
Look, I guess the message is changing very quickly. I was on another Joy program probably 8 weeks ago, and we gave a very different message on that program that day, that condoms are your first line of defence and we will always fall back to condoms. Reading all the PrEP coverage, and particularly in the US gay press and what's going on there with Michael Lucas coming out as a porn director saying he's no longer going to use condoms in his personal life or in his porn because he's on PrEP, and the AIDS Healthcare Foundation saying that PrEP is a party drug and no one should be using it. The messages are certainly changing, and we as an AIDS council are talking to all the other AIDS councils about staying on the cusp of this. We certainly don't want public attitude and public sentiment to move past us and for us to become a relevant organisation. So it's very much the issue of the moment. This is the first of several forums we're going to be running this year. During the conference, we're actually going to be running a forum with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and we'll have people out here who are on PrEP in America right now talking about how it's working and what's not working, what is working. It's certainly an issue that is we're discussing daily in this office.
Yeah, and it's got to be very difficult, though, if one minute your hard line is condoms are always, you know, your first go-to, and then 5 minutes later saying, oh, well, now it's not. And but also as an organisation to have different messages in saying, well, if you're not on PrEP, then condoms are your go-to all the time. But if you are on PrEP, then it's not. Is that a difficult message?
Yeah, it is a difficult message because the research is still out, and we don't, and it was discussed tonight at the forum that, you know, we're still going to encourage people who are on PrEP to use condoms. The partner study has certainly shown up different things that, you know, maybe PrEP isn't the go if your partner, if you're in a serodiscordant relationship and your partner's got an undetectable viral load. But I know today on an earlier program on Joy Today, one of my staff, Colin Bertrini, who's the Director of Health Promotion here, referred to PrEP as protected sex. So the notion that if you're not using condoms, it's unprotected sex, that is something that we need to start thinking about redefining now, because there are biomedical options out there. And in 5 years' time, we might all be on PrEP. That might be our first line of defence in fighting AIDS.
I'm guessing that the ending HIV message, the three-pronged message there, is going to be helpful in this context, in that it is already about condom use. It's already about testing. Yep. It's already about treatment. Do you think, therefore, you can overarch any messages you do with the ending HIV message?
Look, ending HIV, treat early, test often, stay safe. That is still our catch call here, and we will still fall back to that. PrEP, you're looking at, I think it's about going to be $800 a month if it's not on the PBS. Condoms are a lot cheaper. They're a lot more accessible if it's midnight on a Saturday night and you're not on PrEP. You're not going to be getting on it anytime soon, but you can still go and buy a packet of condoms from a 7-Eleven. So, you know, condoms will, I think we're going to be our fallback for a while, but we certainly need to start rethinking our messaging, because we don't want to alienate people who are on PrEP, and we do want to educate people about the range of ways that you can reduce your risk of catching HIV.
Now, Vincent, as a GP, as Simon highlighted there, you know, PrEP's not an immediate thing. Heath from the Free AC last week was talking about there is a window where you need to sort of basically build up your levels. How's it working in as a GP? What's the leading time before you are protected, in inverted commas?
Yeah, so we know from drug level studies that you need to be on PrEP for at least 7 days before you're protected. So you can't just say, okay, I think tonight I'm going to be at risk of HIV, so today I'll pop a PrEP pill and yep, I'll be okay. You need to obviously have some foresight and incorporate PrEP as a regular part of your life in order for it to be effective.
And it's not a case of going in and out either.
No.
So it's not like, okay, I'm going to take it for this month and then I'm not going to take it for a month and then I'm going to take it for a month.
Well no, because when you
could do that, right?
You could do that, except that when you stop PrEP, you need to be on it for at least another 28 days after your last condomless sexual act.
Right.
That's the same time period as you need to be on PEP. So basically in that situation, you're sort of using PrEP as PEP in a way.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. You can draw the analogy there. So you can't just go off 1 month on 1 month, because you need that 28-day exit period and a 7-day lead-in period. So, I mean, you could, you know, I'm not saying if you're going to be on PrEP, you need to be on it all the time, forever and a day, because people, as I alluded to in the talk tonight at the forum, people do go through different phases in their life, and people might have a phase where they have multiple sexual partners and have more risk, and then they might meet someone and, I don't know, fall in love and decide that they're only going to have sex with that person for however long that relationship lasts. So PrEP becomes less and more relevant depending on someone's situation. So you can certainly theoretically be on PEP and off PrEP, but there's some restraints on how quickly on and off you can go. And I think if I can come back to your early point you were discussing with Simon about condoms, I think it's important to keep in mind, and sometimes this seems to get a little bit lost in the discourse, but sexual health is not only about HIV.
Yeah.
And I think currently we're seeing a lot of STIs, we're seeing a lot of syphilis and a lot of gonorrhea. And so I think condoms will always play an important role. But I think PrEP is probably best seen as an adjunct to condom use, because we know that for some people, condoms don't work perfectly 100% of the time. They might use them sometimes. Other times, they might not be in a position where they can use condoms. So PrEP is really useful for those people.
Is the question raised in the US is whether there are drug-resistant HIV strains as a result of PrEP and things like that. Is that the case? Is there any evidence of that?
Well, I mean, in the US and in Australia, we do have drug-resistant HIV strains as a result of people on treatment and there are varying problems with treatment. I think the best thing to refer to would be the IPREX study, that was the results of which were released in 2010, which is the biggest study we've got amongst men who have sex with men on PrEP. And they, during the PrEP phase of that study, no one developed a resistant strain as a result of contracting HIV whilst on PrEP. There were two cases where people had a resistant strain, but in when they did a retrospective analysis of those cases, they found that those people had already contracted HIV before they went on PrEP.
Ah, right.
And then possibly being on PrEP, which PrEP is two drugs as opposed to three drugs. A normal standard HIV treatment is three active drugs. So perhaps because they were on PrEP, which is only two drugs, that may have induced resistance in those people.
If we quickly go back to the condom thing, because I think it needs to be a little bit clearer. The fact that, well, you just said yourself, Vincent, that syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, very prevalent in Melbourne within the community. If people on PrEP are not going to be wearing condoms, is there a conditions apply somewhere? Like, where's the is there an asterisk that says if you're on PrEP, we acknowledge that you're not going to use condoms? Is that what the VAC is saying, Simon?
No. It's not what we're saying at all. We would encourage people to continue to use condoms and then for everything that we just talked about and preventing other STIs. But I think we need to accept that, you know, condom use, it's not on the decrease. There's actually no evidence that condom use is on the decrease. But condoms don't work for all people at all times. And, you know, if you're not wearing a condom, you're putting yourself at risk. But if you're on PrEP, you don't need to think about whether the condom's going to break or whether you've got it on properly or whether you've got one on you.
You'll be at less risk of contracting HIV, sure, but you're still going to be at risk of contracting other STIs.
A range of other STIs, yeah. Yep.
James, as you said a couple of weeks ago, you know, take Berlin for an example. There are a range of, you know, chlamydia and syphilis and those sort of things are prevalent and quite drug resistant strains. So, you know, I'm going to go to Berlin for a month and I'm going to take PrEP for the month beforehand and then do it while I'm there, and then that's not going to protect you from from all these drug resistant other STIs.
And I think one thing that the studies in America have found, because they were the people who were on the drugs didn't know if they were going to, whether they were on the drugs or not. That's correct.
That's correct.
They didn't change their behaviour, because you're not going to be risky if you're not going, if you don't know if you're on the drug or not. So I think one thing that this study in Melbourne wants to find out is if people are knowingly on the drug, will their behaviour change? And I think that's something that is a very interesting, which is going to be a very interesting outcome, A. And B, scarily, might not give us the results that we're after.
True. Simon, can we just move on to something else for a moment? You wrote an article that was published yesterday on the Gay News Network, MCV. Yeah. It was an interesting little article, arguing that the gay community should learn from our Aboriginal brothers and sisters, who themselves have their community-controlled health organisations, and you're arguing that we should have queer community-controlled health organisations. Do you want to run us through very briefly your argument for that?
Well, we actually do have queer community-controlled health organisations. The Victorian AIDS Council is one of them. There's a number of others. I think you could probably argue Brown Market Clinic and Northside Clinic are queer community-controlled health organisations. And we can learn a lot from our Aboriginal brothers and sisters. I guess our case is, particularly in an age of funding cuts, last year we saw massive funding cuts across hospital networks all across Victoria where there were federal funding cuts. We also saw cuts of 10 to 20% of health promotion budgets through our community health centres. When mainstream health organisations are getting cuts, they're going to fall back to their core business. They're going to say, what's their core business? That's what we need to be offering. GLBTI health is not necessarily their core business. Diversity health is not necessarily their core business, and they're not necessarily going to stand up and fight for that. Organisations like ours, it is our core business. If there was no need for GLBTI health, we wouldn't exist. People would just go to mainstream providers. And so with the GLBTI MAC currently offering its recommendations back to the state government, and we're expecting a range of promises coming up into this election about funding that's going to go into healthcare for gay and lesbian and bi and trans people, we would argue that it should go to organisations controlled by gay, lesbian, bi and trans people, because we know our communities. We're prepared to fight for them, and we're also prepared to take risks. And in that article, I did talk about a time when the VAC organised a campaign around PEP, as it turned out, and the state government, even though they'd been involved in designing the campaign, suddenly got a bit shaky on it because it showed a man's bare bum. And we fought hard and we said this campaign's going to work, and it actually did work, and we put the campaign out there and there was no negative response to that campaign. And I don't know that a mainstream organisation would have actually done that. They wouldn't have taken that fight.
Do you think that the ministerial advisory committee will be recommending for queer community-controlled health organisations to operate more effectively on a statewide basis?
I don't know that they'll make any direct recommendations around queer community-controlled health organisations, but they will make recommendations around expansions and new money going into GLBTI healthcare. And so I guess what I'm arguing is, you know, and our organisations don't cover the whole state, and, you know, there's a lot of work we can do, and in a lot of areas, mainstream organisations do a very good job at this sort of work. But what I would be arguing is that we actually do it better and we're more committed to it and we're always going to fight for it. If we get a funding cut, when we go in to argue for more money, we're always going to argue for more money to come back into GLBTI healthcare. If a mainstream agency has to cut its queer programs, it's not necessarily going to argue for those ones back.
Is there some kind of precedent that has led you to believe this?
You know, there's an example in South Australia where the AIDS Council has been defunded and a mainstream agency has received that money. If the mainstream agency was to lose that money, I don't know that they'd go back and fight for it, but certainly an AIDS Council would, and we're seeing similar things in Queensland where gay-led organisations are losing their funding and the funding's being dispersed across mainstream agencies. And certainly in the Aboriginal space, what we can learn is that if you can run healthcare, you can do it well and your community connects to you. And Aboriginal people certainly flock to Aboriginal controlled healthcare. And I think we can follow their lead and learn a lot from them around who should be controlling our health. It should be us controlling our future.
And some would argue that a queer community health organisation, you know, is catering for 10%+ of the population, and Aboriginal communities is a lot smaller, particularly here in Victoria. There's an argument for it.
Yes, I'll be arguing for that.
Simon, Ruth, thank you so much for joining us on Hide and Seek.
Cheers, anytime.
And Dr. Vincent, thank you so much for dropping by as well.
Thank you for having me.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.